Parker Millsap, and Searcy. Plus a silent auction and much more. Tickets are $20 and it all goes to support KPFT. The party's going on at McGonigal's Mucky Duck, 2425 Norfolk, just off Kirby and 59. It's Sunday, March 16th. Thanks for supporting KPFT Houston.
You're listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston.
Listeners should be aware that the following program contains language and audio images which may be found disturbing and may not be suitable for your snotty-nosed little brat who probably cusses like a sailor behind your back anyway. Parental discretion is advised.
Greetings and welcome to this edition of Technology Bites.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Technology Bites.
Top secret speaking going on in the studio.
I'm Jay Lee.
Take the shot.
Peter Hughes, we're probably recording a message to Peter Hughes right now.
Oh, good.
Hi, Peter.
Hi, Pete.
Hi, Pete.
Call us.
Yawa me. All right, well, welcome to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee. Somewhere out in the ether is Peter.
Afflicted.
I'm Barrett.
And he's
Groovehouse.
Super secret Groovehouse.
Super secret.
What is that red light you flashed at me? Is that your mouse?
Maybe.
Maybe. Or are you presenting? I don't know, maybe you're some kind of angler fish or something.
How's that? Does that turn you on, Jay?
It does.
Makes cue up the Barry White.
Oh, where's Dwight when you need him?
Need is such a...
That's a strong word.
All right, hey, Pete, welcome to the show.
Hey, I was here all along.
Somebody messed with the board and they changed the input.
Probably just between me and studio.
Studio.
Or me and soundboard. It's or
Pepcast.
Flicted's keyboard.
Well, you know. We'd hate to have a smooth intro to any of our shows.
Flichter does everything he can to get everything perfectly set up in the 20 seconds he gets here before the show. It's...
I know. He spends so much time prepping his extensive and well-thought-out intros that I can understand he wouldn't have time to set up the connection.
Sorry. You're listening to Technology Bytes Radio, and this is Flichted with Technology Bytes Radio. Flichted. Radio.
Well, we're glad you could tune in for this madcap mayhem of Tech Talk Radio. Yippee. You can visit us online at geekradio.com. That is the website where we keep all the particulars and the pertinence. And you can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/geekradio. You can get the link to that from our website as well. You can hang out with us in IRC, irc.cuckoo.com, in the channel Tech Bytes, which is the show within a show. And or if you don't want to use your own IRC client, you can always just join up using the web client that we have posted on our website. So there's that. And we'll be curious to know, how has XP officially, is it dead now?
Oops. I should have updated all those XP machines at work, I guess. I think, it, no, I thought it was the 14th.
It might
Let
be
me go see the date. Or was it the 12th?
I don't remember what the end of life is.
I know I got a few updates.
What's that?
I know I got a few updates last week.
Did you?
Yeah.
All right. I'm bleeding them dry.
So it's still working.
April 8th, so it's gone. It's still got, no. It's March.
It's March.
We got time. Okay.
Yeah.
We got time.
Do not freak out yet.
Don't panic. Well, you can panic, but...
Don't panic and rush out and buy a computer that's about 30 times faster than the old POS that you're running XP on right now.
I made the mistake of writing an article about the end of life XP for the Houston Chronicle, and you know my readers, bless their hearts. You know a lot of them are getting on in years, and so are their computers.
They're near EOL.
But somebody actually, you know, it's like they contacted me and they said I have a 3-year-old. Computer running Windows 7, what should I do? And I went, nothing. You're fine.
Enjoy it.
I'm not, it wasn't, you know, I realize that some of my readers, if I mention how to fix something, they'll go check to see if it's fixed. Like if I say, here's how you address such and such a problem, they'll go dig around in the registry just to see what's happening. Or if I say, here's a program, somebody says, I need a program to do such and such, oh, you can download this, they'll go get it. They don't need it.
Yeah.
It's just like,
if it ain't broke, we'll break it.
Whatever. It's like this. It reminds me of those people that, you know, when computer magazines came with those CDs with like 1,000 utilities on everything.
Install everything.
Well, I don't know what it does, but I'm going to fill up my 40 meg hard drive every bit of it.
There are still users who will click on anything that pops up on the screen.
Yes. You
know, same thing.
Yes.
Same thing. An ad pops
Entire up. Hacking industries are built off that. Yeah, presumption.
And the NSA, that's how the NSA is doing
it. I'll do it. Click.
Sounds like a good idea. What's the harm? All right. So, anyway, we had a geek gathering last Friday. Groovehouse wasn't there, but
I was working. Sorry.
It was fun. We got the machine booted. We got the Osborne 1 booted finally.
Somebody came to the geek gathering with an Osborne 1. Looking for a home, and Barrett said, me!
And a T-1000.
And yeah, but Barrett's trying to
Terminator.
Pawn that off.
Actually, I think we found a home for that.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Barrett said, no, the Osborne's mine. On my motorcycle, I will take a cab home to get this to my house.
Wow.
Yeah.
And it was on the verge of firing up at the Geek Gathering, but it didn't.
The screen would power up, but it would just flicker. It wouldn't do anything. Yeah, the huge 5-inch, crisp 80 by, I think, 40 display.
I mean, that's, wow. that computer is all computer and this tiny little, like, watch face size screen. It's tiny. So,
yeah, you cracked it open several times. David, the guy that brought all the tech up there, finally got it booted. And,
very
of course,
nice.
No one was around to see. But, yeah, he was really cool. Hopefully he'll come
Have
out.
Have you done anything with it?
Not. I opened up the case again. It's immaculately clean inside. I was going to try and see. There's a loose connection. That's what the deal is. So I'm trying to, like, replicate the loose connection. Of course, I've not been able
replicate
to.
It.
I'm trying to like set it down in such a way that that connection. No. To where the monitor does the same thing, the screen does the same thing, so I can like solder it down, or I can figure out what the loose connection is.
So you can touch it and watch it go on.
Yeah,
and
exactly. Even to the point where we had it running down, he had it booted up, and then someone set down a beer, and the thing blinked off again. It's like that sensitive. It's like you've got to give it the Fonz jukebox maneuver, and I need to figure out where that where the Fonzie spot is.
He's looking for the Fonzie spot on the computer, and that's not a euphemism.
No.
Sort of actually is, though, actually. All right, so we're
just
glad.
Just waiting for Leather Tuscadero.
Hey!
Well, we're glad you could tune in. We're going to have a great show tonight. If you want to be on the air with us, the phone number is 713-526-5738. We'll be opening up the lines in a little bit here. But first, we're going to go to San Antonio and take care of the Technology Bytes Info Shot with Peter Hughes. Take it away, Info Shot.
It's the Technology Bytes Info Shot. Technology news and commentary by Peter Hughes. Injected directly into your skull.
All right, well, we'll start with, this was an interesting one. This weekend there's that jetliner that went missing that, obviously, we know it didn't land where it's supposed to go, but that's kind of the limits of it right now. Two fascinating things is, one, isn't it amazing that a 777 could disappear in this day and age? But then the second one is kind of more amazing, which is that some of the search for this missing jetliner or any kind of evidence of what happened to it is being crowdsourced. More than 2 million people are searching for clues in satellite imagery that could point to the whereabouts of Malaysia Airlines Flight 370, that jetliner that disappeared. The digital search effort is taking place on TomNod, a crowdsourcing platform from Digital Globe, which operates 5 high-resolution commercial satellites and provides imagery to companies like Google. On Monday, they kicked off a campaign and invited people to volunteer their time to comb through images for signs of the missing jet. Since then, people have collectively responded to the call by tagging more than 650,000 objects of interest from available images. Although altogether, TomNod has witnessed more than 98 million map views, with every pixel available having been scanned by human eyes at least 30 times. Pretty amazing. TomNod relies on complex algorithms to filter through the hundreds of thousands of tags being reported by volunteers, who are also assigned reliability scores based on their reports. So if you're just bad enough and you're giving them all kinds of garbage, nobody's going to look at it anyway. And then clues go funneled through the process until the best ones are handed off to a team of expert analysts who look through the tips. So basically, people are acting as the kind of initial easy filter. So on the one hand, the plane disappears and it's like, poof, well, where'd it go? On the other hand, we can have 95 million views of 30 views of every single pixel of imagery for the areas that they've at least mapped so far, in a few days. So it's kind of interesting how it's kind of an interesting contrast. I guess I'll just leave it there. And another interesting contrast between doing your job and being a douche company. there's an article, and it's in Newsweek, so you can read more of it yourself. But essentially, it's talking about something that has been kind of getting covered lately. The telecom giants made a vow to provide nationwide broadband service in the United States by 2020. And that was tied in with all kinds of legislation and stuff. And so for 20 years, AT&T, Verizon, and all these other big, internet providers have been collecting hundreds of billions of dollars through rate increases and surcharges and things like that. Look at your bill. You can see them. But after wiring the high density, quote, high and high profit big cities, they now say it's too expensive to do the rest of the job. But on the other hand, it's too expensive to do. But they'd like to keep all that money that they got, that they banked for the project. Isn't that sweet? In 2010, the FCC announced the National Broadband Plan, which promised to provide 100 million American households with high-speed cable by 2020. Verizon has been expanding Fios in major markets, and AT&T has been expanding UVerse. And now, instead of spending that war chest digging up streets and laying fiber, the cable and telephone companies have invested in a massive and very successful lobbying push. Of course, it's cheaper to pay the referees and the people who make you do your job. You know, basically, this is the equivalent of if you had enough money to pay your boss to pretend that you did a really good job and still pocket your paycheck. So they're persuading state legislatures and regulatory boards to quietly adopt new rules, rules that the telecoms wrote themselves, to eliminate their legal obligations to provide broadband service nationwide and replace landlines with wireless. This abrupt change in plans will leave vast areas of the country with poor service, slow to telecommunications, and higher bills. So if you own stock in those companies, then that may be to your benefit, but otherwise not. There's a book out, and I can't remember off the top of my head the title, but if you want to be outraged about how lame, you know, there's a lot of people, you know, America, rah, rah, and, you know, this is a wonderful country, and we're number one, except one of the things that's incumbent on you if you want to have a number one country is you have to actually be number one in things. And our broadband and our internet is laughable. For the country that invented the internet, we are so low on the as far as the rankings of countries for speed and cost. The countries that you would compare the United States, one example I heard in an interview with the author on NPR, New York City. So you're talking about one of the premier cities in the United States. Their internet in terms of price and broadband speed is roughly equivalent to Turkey. So New York City and Turkey, the most things, they don't have anything in common. You know, like one is full of millionaires and the other one is a maybe second world country. So that's how we stack up. And meanwhile, all the charges and all the money that we've paid, you and I have paid into these companies, is going to go into their pockets instead of into internet for more people or better internet for all of us. You know, it's a sad thing. Thank God for Google. If you notice, if you've watched in Austin, where there's real competition, then the other side steps up. Google puts in gigabit internet in Austin, and suddenly AT&T and Time Warner Cable, they're going to put gigabit in. Everywhere else, go suck eggs, you know? So this is pathetic. It's sad. It's one of those things where whichever side of the political spectrum you're on, you shouldn't be believing in companies collecting fees for stuff that they never deliver or collecting surcharges to do services that then they never provide. And if they do that, they shouldn't get to keep the money. That should come back to us or be taken from them and given to some company that will. Anyways, so sorry, the bit article/soapbox, but this is pathetic. This is really sad. And any other place, if you come to a business and you give them money and then they don't do what they promised and they don't give you your money back, that's called fraud. But apparently if you're a big enough telecom, then suddenly things like what's legal or not become blurry. In other blurry rip-you-off news, this is one, if it sounds too stupid to be true, then it isn't. I don't know if you heard the thing about the miracle machine that would turn water and grape concentrate and yeast into wine in your very own home, but it was made up. You know, it's one of those where really how many people really believed it who weren't like breathless media hosts of shows trying to fill time. The Miracle Machine's founders promised a Kickstarter launch, which never happened. It was just a hook to get people to sign up for more information. This part, it's like one of those where, I'm sorry, doing this kind of stuff, even for a potentially good cause, is lame. Today, the people who signed up for this miracle machine got an email leading them to a video about Wine to Water, a nonprofit organization dedicated to supplying clean drinking water to people in need around the globe. You know, when you have to do that from fraud, I don't think, you know, I don't know why you would think that's a great idea to, like, get a bunch of people's attention and then tell them they were fooled by your lie and then say, oh, but I've got this great cause that I really want you to invest in. So anyways, that was an odd one. I know I heard several news reports on it, and it was one of those that kind of seemed scammy. But this one's another interesting one. we heard a few, you know, a few years ago, we heard all about mesh networks, and that was going to be really, you know, a big deal. And then it kind of went nowhere, except in some of the hacker, some hackery areas, maybe did some. Home security and automation company Vivint is planning to use a gigabit Wi-Fi mesh network on its customers' rooftops to some communities in Utah. They're trialing a 50 megabit per second residential broadband for about under $60 a month in Utah, and they're using unlicensed airwaves, the same spectrum used by Wi-Fi and Bluetooth, but they didn't give away – in their initial announcement, they didn't give away a lot of details. Now it's become clearer they're using gigabit Wi-Fi chips in their network, and they've invested in the company that makes those chips. Vivint is using Quantenna's Wi-Fi technologies to create rooftop mesh networks that connect back to a neighborhood hub, which in turn links to a fiber node through a point-to-point microwave connection. That sounds like what I'd like one of those, at least for my house, just internal to the house. They're using 802.11n chips in the rooftop gear, but starting in the second half of the year, they're going to advance. They're going to go to the 802.11ac technologies, and it's not the 802.11ac that's in your Airport Extreme router. It's a newer version called Wave 2, which makes use of multi-user, multiple input, multiple output, MU-MIMO, to give you another like cool acronym, smart antenna techniques to deliver powerful broadband links to several different devices separately. First Wave 2 routers are starting to make their way into the market, but no smartphones or laptops can take advantage of their full capabilities yet. A mesh topology can, though, because both the transmitting and receiving device have the same technical capabilities. So we'll keep an eye on that one. I think cool mesh networks. One of the things is, frankly, if this technology gets a little bit more of a foothold, if it works for them and it's not hideously expensive, then you get a chance for maybe more people to thank you. Phone calls. That must be – hey, that guy must be on the air, so we'll make dogs bark and phones ring. Anyways, this could be something useful to, especially when it gets into more hackery hands, to providing broadband to all those places that AT&T, Verizon, and others want to ignore. In cool high-end audio news, the Pono Player, which is a music playback device backed by Neil Young, went on Kickstarter, and within 24 hours, it hit its target on crowdfunding. It actually doubled its target in crowdfunding within 24 hours of launching, and apparently the pledging period is set to continue for another 33 days, so they will have a serious amount of money in hand when it comes time to do the player. It's the high-end audio, it's designed to be high-end audio. It's triangular-shaped. If you look it up, it's P-O-N-O player, and it's supposed to be kind of the audiophile, uncompressed audio type device that Neil Young wants to listen to. And apparently a lot of people are willing to pony up some cash to get one when they come out. In other news, Google Wallet has added a new feature, which is kind of cool. They had an update today. It's available for iOS and Android devices. It has an orders feature that allows you to track online orders as well as access past transaction history information in one location. Once it's activated in Google Wallet, users can view any receipts sent to their Gmail account within the app. U.S. package carriers can now send notifications of order status updates through Wallet, so you can know where your item is. So it's putting together a lot of these things that you used to have to go to, you know, who you bought something from, and then find the link to the tracking info and then look it up on their site to figure out where the heck your thingy that you bought is. So that's a cool cool feature. In other cool new features from the Microsoft and Mac area, Microsoft Office is going to release a new version of Microsoft is going to release a new version of Microsoft Office for the Mac this year, according to a report published today in Macworld. Representative Microsoft confirmed that the development work for the next version of Office for Mac is ongoing. They don't have exact details on timing, but Office 365 subscribers will automatically get the next Office for Mac at no additional cost. So it's going to... You know, if you've been waiting for that, I think the last there was an Office for Mac 2011 was the most recent, and I'm sure that the PC side has gotten an update since then that the Mac has not. And in other Microsoft update news, OneNote, which is an Evernote competitor, sort of, and I know that a lot of people have spoken well of it. I believe Dwight uses it to create blog posts. One of the things that it's not been available on is a Mac, where for OS X, and there's a report that Microsoft OneNote for OS X is coming this month, and that it will be free. It's one of the few major software platforms without a dedicated OneNote client. iOS has it. Android and Windows Phone 8 are already supported. So you have to, if you want to use access it from your Mac, you had to do it through the OneNote web app. But that's limited compared to the offline clients. So if you're a OneNote type person and you also like to use it on a Mac, I know that for the software that I have, like Evernote is a good example, and it's kind of a competitor to OneNote. When you can go on any device and use it, when I can use it on my iOS device, you know, an iPad or an iPhone, also on a like a Nexus 7 with Android, or on a PC or on a Mac, and I can call up that same data from the cloud, that's of high value. So the more platforms it's on, the better for it. So if you like OneNote and you like also have a Mac, this would be good news for you. And that on that good news, I'm going to end the news, and I'm Peter Hughes.
That's the opening track to the Pono Player. Sorry. That just sounds true. They misnamed that. Yeah. Awkward silence.
R is silent.
I heard the I heard the media that you play on is called pornography.
This is why you tune in, folks.
Pono.
I got pwned.
Do you pwn these things, or do you just rent them? All right, well, we're going to open up the phone lines now. Save us. Please save us from the conversation that's erupting in the studio, that's rising up here in the...
713-526-5738 if you'd like to be on the air with us.
All right.
Lots of lines open.
So. All the lines are open, except for one.
Right.
What's better, Groovehouse?
I was talking over you, and I apologize.
I was talking over you, and
we
apologize.
Talking over
I wasn't
each other.
Talking over either one of y'all.
Ding dong.
Bling, bling.
Yeah, really. Gee, I put on a real show how to be professional on the radio.
Answer
huh?
your phone, Pete. We're trying to call you.
Put the dog in the other room.
You're trying to call me and say, hey, what's the deal with the dog?
Silence the dog. Bring, bring. All right, Groovehouse.
Yes.
Let's see if we have a call in the queue.
We do.
Let's have it.
All right, up first on the show, we are going to speak with Gary.
Gary, on the air with Technology Bites.
Hello, I have two questions. And the first question, I read a letter to Jay Lee in the Chronicle, and I'm one of those old farts. I had to go ask my wife if I didn't write that letter and forgot. And what it's about is I also have a 9-year-old Dell computer with Windows XP. And we all know, and by the way, I didn't catch it, but the cutoff date is April 8th.
We found it.
Okay. And my first question is fairly abstract, and you may not be able to answer it, but with all the malware and viruses and everything, I assume that these people are searching for data, and I have never, in the entire time I've owned this computer, used it. I've never put any data on there. I don't pay my bills on the computer. My bank account's not on the computer. My Social Security number's not. And I just, like the guy in the letter said, I go on email and I hit a blog spot now and then. And I'm wondering, do the people that initiate these viruses, would they bother with somebody? I mean, we don't get any further, you know, security updates, but what would they care if somebody goes to a poetry site? Aren't they mining
their data? Well,
it's
not like they're targeting you specifically.
Is it a shotgun effect? They just send it to everybody?
It's dynamite in the pond. It's dynamite. You know, it's just basically it takes them no additional. It's not like they're going to say, okay, I'm going to break out my snack treats and light a cigarette and sit down at my computer and spend the next 2 to 3 days hacking on.
We're going after Gary.
Gary's computer. This stuff is just code that's spread out there. It's all over the place. It's on websites. It's wherever. And people stumble on it. And so sometimes somebody stumbles on it and they've got good info and people can snarf that. Somebody stumbles on it, they don't have any good info, they move on.
Well, but there's also a lot of reasons that a system could be compromised. So it's not just necessarily they're going to look for your bank information or something like that. They could also be looking to get into your email account and try to use your email account to email other people to try to get money from them or to trick them into thinking that they're you to do something.
That's a robobot, right? What do they call them?
Well, it's just a.
So it's just pure evil. I mean, they're not really trying to steal your information. They're just screwing everybody.
Well, there's several different factions of these kind of people out there. There's the people that are trying to get money. You know, they're figuring out ways to compromise people's bank accounts and compromise their identities. Then there's people out there that they only seem to be interested in just causing chaos and trouble. We used to do it when we were kids. When the internet started up, you think, well, I wonder what I can do with all of this. And so you try to get access to a system to see if you can do it. You try to understand how things work. So you have to try things out. So there are people like that out in the world that are just playing around. Some of it's malicious and some of it isn't.
So despite my minimal usage, I should be concerned.
Well, you know, it's all, you know, you. Unless you have a really, really, really good understanding of how all of that works, you want to certainly exercise caution. Even if you do have a good understanding, you want to exercise caution.
Be aware of it, but don't lose any sleep over it.
Okay, well, I got you. And I do have some antivirus programs. Now, the other...
Well, part... I was going to make one more point before we go on to the next question, and that is that if you are... If you really don't have anything on your computer you're worried about losing... If you find yourself compromised by spyware and viruses, it can certainly affect the way your computer performs. Even if you're not losing your identity or losing your bank account, you're losing time because your computer bogs down. It pops up a bunch of error messages. It behaves erratically. So, you know, you want to be careful for that reason, too. And as long as you're not worried about losing data, you can always reinstall your system. If you do get
infected... Possibly depends on what your computer is used to do as well, not as you, because the source IP of your computer will be seen by whoever, if somebody compromises your computer. I mean, if it gets used in a botnet to do a denial of service attack against Amazon.com, probably nothing's going to happen. But if it happens to get compromised by people who are using it as a proxy for child pornography, you might have the FBI come into your house. I mean, that's way less likely than it being used in a denial of service attack on something or something like that. But that possibility does exist, even though it's small.
Okay, now I have a question 1A before I get to question 2, and you brought this up. I used to be a member of a car club, which I'm not anymore, but I still get all, and I was a member of Smithsonian and National Geographic, and I get all the kind of mailers in the mail because I was on a list.
Right.
Now, how do you get on a list to be the subject of a malware attack? I mean, how would they even...
Well, that doesn't always just come in via email, but if you want to talk about how email gets compromised, if you sign up on any website with your email address, they might sell your email address to a third party, and those email lists get passed around.
Or much more obscure, but also very likely is if anybody that you've emailed to or has emailed you gets their email account compromised, then they find your address in the pool and they start using it too.
Right. There's a number of ways that can happen.
Yeah, there's a lot of ways.
You just answered my second question. I got my AARP magazine, and they had a list of do's and don'ts regarding internet. And one of them was, do you open emails from people that you don't know. Now, I always thought that it was the attachment you opened that would infect your computer. If you just open an email from John Smith, does that infect your computer?
It can.
It can.
There are exploits, you know, because certain emails have code in them. They're not just plain text. It's not like just typing on a typewriter. There's code in there that shows it, allows the there to be images inside of the email. They can link back to malicious sites, or, you know, you can open an email, and if your computer is not secure, it can be compromised just by opening the email.
It's kind of a constant cat and mouse game between people trying to protect computers and people trying to abuse them and break into them. So yeah, originally years ago when emails arrived, you were safe to open it. Basically, you had to open an attachment and choose to run something. But then people figured out that, I guess it was for convenience sake, specifically Windows would auto-open attachments, or you could actually embed stuff in a message so that they gave you a preview window, so you could actually be infected not even opening it, just when it arrived, if you had your preview window available where it would show you a preview of the message. So that's gone back and forth, you know. Somebody figures out how to get around the security, and then the people have to come in and correct the security. And so, yeah, it's entirely possible from opening an email that you could possibly get infected.
I'm afraid. I'm very afraid.
Well, like, you know, the main thing is that, a computer really is just a box full of software. If something happens to your computer, if it gets compromised, you know, it usually will start demonstrating behavior that'll tip you off. You'll start to see error messages. You'll start to see things pop up that you don't recognize. The computer will crash. It will have problems. You can always just reload the software if you can't clean that stuff off with a good antivirus program.
Well, I haven't had any problems of that nature, and my usage is very minimal, and I go to poetry sites like anybody would care. But should I be concerned about this stopping of updates for XP? I mean, do you think it's just, why would they bother with XP these days?
Well, why do they bother? Like,
because
I said,
there's still a lot of them around.
It's like, it's not even that they have to bother with it. It's like, again, it goes back to, like, it's just throwing a stick of dynamite in the pond. You know, if you send the malware out there and it's particularly fond of XP computers and XP computers are out there to receive it, they get infected. It doesn't cost the hackers any more time or effort to infect 1,000 computers than it does to affect one computer, because it's just software.
I would say another thing to just, you know, scare you some more is that if any site gets compromised, website gets compromised, then a person can put code on a website so that when a person goes to that website, that page that loads tries to install something on your computer or get you to run something. That can be done through advertisement that has malware in it that's just auto-loaded, or somebody actually compromising a system and actually intentionally putting malware on the web page.
Well, let me be really, really clear on one thing, and that is that regardless of whether there's updates or not for XP, XP is a very vulnerable operating system at its best. That being said, just about any operating system is vulnerable to attack. Any, whether it's Unix, whether it's a Mac, whether it's Windows 8.1.
There's some way in.
There's some way in, and a lot of times that way in is the user lets them in. The person who owns the computer.
That's completely the easiest way.
Makes the mistake of double-clicking on something or clicking on a link or opening a file that they shouldn't. So whether or not XP is supported going down the road, you still have to be careful. If you're going to use Windows XP, if you're going to buy a new computer with Windows 8 on it, you still have to be careful.
I have one last thing. I was reading in the newspaper that the state of Florida, a very prominent journalist there, said that there were more criminals in Florida than people. Do you think there's more hackers than users out there?
No.
I mean, it's getting a little crazy, isn't it?
I think journalists still can't do math.
Thanks, guys.
All right, thank you for your call.
Goodbye.
Yes, sadly, there's more journalists writing breathless stories about hacking than there are hackers actually out there really doing anything that's not script kiddie stuff.
Well, the thing is again, you don't need a one hacker for every user. One hacker can take down a lot of users, so there's not more hackers out there. But because of how fast and how easy it is to send data from point A to point B over the internet, all these computers that are connected to the internet are connected to each other in some way.
The thing is, usually there's like maybe, you know, a couple hundred brilliant hackers that are actually doing really cool stuff.
Not malicious stuff necessarily.
Not even necessarily.
We keep saying hackers in the bad term, but,
well,
you know.
People that are figuring out weaknesses in systems.
Black hats.
Right? Black hat or not. I mean, a white hat might not release the
information. Information security researcher.
But there's a couple hundred probably brilliant people that are doing like cutting edge, zero day exploit kind of work, and then either it gets out or they announce it or they give it to somebody, and then at some point you end up with a couple thousand people that aren't as brilliant that are using this exact same thing to try to attack millions and millions of computers.
Well,
and it doesn't take long for that to happen.
We're talking about hackers, and we're talking about whether they're good people or they're bad people and whatever people are up to. There's a story that came out today about the NSA and their plans to infect millions of computers.
Black hats.
NSA's evil.
Yeah, they're black hats.
Script kiddies.
Everybody, I think everybody's a shade of gray. I don't think there's really any white or black hat, really. It's...
Well, somebody apparently wanted to. I see a note from Groovehouse on the phone system here. I want to get out the phone number, though, real quick. 713-526-5738 if you want to be on the air with Technology Bites tonight. Somebody, was that a different caller that you had?
Yes, it was another caller who called in who couldn't stay on the line, but he was curious as to the generalities of the XP situation. You know, we're not going to get updates, but what else, can we expect, from the situation?
Well, with XP,
is Microsoft going to use that code anymore at all, or is this the end? This is the end of life for the 98 base code, right? Like everything after.
I thought they
XP
were going to bring it back
into
Windows 10.
No, I think it's the last. It's the last of the of that code. Everything's gone to
so
the
NT
base.
Do you think they'll release that code and a third party might take security for it?
Did they do that with Windows 3.1 or 95?
No.
No, they didn't.
I don't think so.
No.
They are missing the money train on this, though. They could. I'm sure if they did like support licenses or stuff like that, they could actually scare some money up.
Well, first of all, nobody I know uses Microsoft for support. Like, call them up and say, I'm having a problem with my computer. I've got licensed software. Help me fix this problem. Nobody does that. They call into radio shows like this, or they write newspaper columnists, or they go online and they find the answer. So XP, even when it was supported, it wasn't supported. You didn't necessarily avail yourself of any of the options that you might have had. So now Microsoft has said, we are no longer going to update Windows XP. We're not. If somebody discovers another vulnerability in it, vulnerability number 2,735,201, we're not going to patch it. It's just going to be vulnerable as it ever was. If somebody comes up with a new exploit for Windows XP, it's going to just be there. Does that mean that XP is going to get somehow less secure and more vulnerable as time goes by? Yeah, a little bit. But again, most of the stuff that I see in my day-to-day when I'm working with people that use computers, the malware and stuff gets on there can get on any computer with any operating system. If the user's not careful, if they click on a bad link, if they install bad software, the computer's going to get infected. It's unfortunate, for people that have bought XP. A lot of people that are running XP, obviously, it's like 9 years now, 10 years now, and the computer's humming along and it's doing the best it can, and it's probably just fine for a lot of people. And as I was telling the previous caller, if you're using a Windows XP computer and you don't have a bunch of personal data stored on it, and you're not doing all your banking on it or whatever, and you're just using it to browse the web and send and receive email, it'll keep doing that for as long as it can hold up. The reality is that a computer that's 9 or 10 years old is going to probably just decide to fail without warning. Just one day you're going to go and turn it on and it's not going to turn on. And at that point, you're looking at I wouldn't get it fixed. You could buy another used XP-based computer for less than what it costs you to repair one. But you're probably looking at buying a new computer. So you're going to find a computer with Windows 7 or Windows 8. You're going to be facing those challenges anyway. What's going to really be nice is that if you ever do finally ditch that old XP computer, you're going to get a brand new computer. And it's going to blow your mind with how fast it is, all the features and functionalities and capability that it has. It's so worth it to buy a new computer. But I do know, I deal with these people every day, and bless their hearts. They're the kind of people that probably have a pristine 1962 automobile in their garage that they drive once a week, or still runs, and they baby and they take care of it. There's that mentality from my generation and older that says, if you buy something, it should just continue doing whatever it does, and I'll maintain it and I'll take care of it, and this will be the only computer I'll have for the rest of my life. And that's not how technology works, unfortunately, because the other thing to consider is that the software that you like to use, the things that you're going to want to use the computer for, are going to continue, and they already have started to continue to stop working on XP. So you're going to encounter online content that will not run on an XP computer. There will be a program that comes out that does everything you need it to do to make your life wonderful, and it's not going to run on XP. You're going to go out and buy the latest, greatest, whatever, and it's just not going to have any capability of running on your computer. If you have XP and you're only using it to browse web and send email, I figure you've got several years left to be able to continue to do that, at least a few more years to do that, if not longer. But at some point, you should really consider getting a newer computer. I will say that my experience has shown me that Windows 7 and Windows 8 are less vulnerable to malware and viruses. They're not immune, but they're less vulnerable, certainly, than an XP computer. And if you're not the kind of person who runs afoul of that stuff, then keep on going. But if you are the kind of person that stumbles around and makes mistakes with their computers, then consider updating your technology. 713-526-5738 if you want to be on the air with Technology Bites. All of our lines are open. We're happy to talk about the end of life with XP. Also, it's although some people are kind of challenging this, supposedly it's the 25th anniversary of the World Wide Web.
Yes. Yes, it is.
Because Lee, what's his
Tim,
name?
Tim Berners-Lee. Yeah, he put out a document. This is so Barrett time. This is all I have for Barrett time.
Oh, okay. Should we
wait?
Can a dog bark or a bell ring right now to take the focus off Barrett time? Yeah, we should wait.
Okay. Well,
if that's cool, can everyone hang on 16 more minutes?
Oh, yes. Yes.
No.
Afflicted can't.
I mean, yes. We waited 25 years.
I'm going to propose that we talk about it, and then the actual talking about it will happen later. Much like Lee did with the World Wide Web. All right, so 713-526-5738 if you want to be on the air. It's about 12 minutes before the top of the hour, so we've got time to take a call or two before we go into our station break. And then when we come back for the second hour, we will do Barrett time and talk to you about that. What else? What other anniversaries are things
that would
going
be
on?
89, though, right?
Yes.
Yes.
There. So the here's what I also
no,
found.
No, 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 don't,
no. But this isn't in Barrett time.
Spoiler alert!
Spoiler alert! The finding like the original day that the World Wide Web was born is a lot like coming across like the oldest pub in Ireland. There are a lot of dates out there, and they're all kind of maybe correct. There's some plausibility. So this
should,
is one of the earliest
should be
plausible
around 91,
dates.
91, right?
New. We'll get into it.
Okay. Will be discussed
exhaustively.
We'll leave room for discussion. I've got 30 seconds of Barrett time, and then we can fill in the rest with that.
What about HyperCard? Doesn't that go back before?
Before the web?
Yeah,
I believe.
Yeah, it does.
It does.
Yeah,
because they wanted to tie all that together.
It was kind of a. Conceptually similar.
Hypertext. There were a lot of people working on how they thought it should work. I mean, there was HyperCard from Apple was out, I believe, in that time frame,
right.
And there was the concept. Who was that? There was somebody who had that big concept of the kind of of a hypertext document that he'd been working on for decades. I remember reading an article in Wired in the 90s, and they were still working on it. And I even had a friend in college who got into hypertext, and that got him his first job at a company that did manuals for Boeing. You know, he was explaining hypertext to me back before all of that, and it's like, you want to go, yeah, I was so visionary, I just really understood what... No, I didn't get it. Yeah. I couldn't see. He was trying to do a hypertext newspaper, and Tim Berners-Lee is a genius for figuring out the things he did for kind of basically how it should work.
See, the first time I ever saw a web page, which I want to say was in the spring of 93... Something like that, maybe spring of 93 or something, maybe 94, maybe early 94. Anyway, whatever the case, it's a long time ago. And the first time I saw it, I just was like, yeah, so what? Like, this is interesting, but so what? And now, a lot of people, when you say the internet, that's all they think the internet is web pages.
You mean it's not? And that's it for Barrett time.
Gopher.
Yeah, because I was like, I'm just going to go back to my VT terminal and use news groups and chat.
I think Waze is going to be the Google killer. I think it's the up-and-coming search.
I think Gopher Space, when there was – did you ever see the like sort of second-generation Gopher thing? It had an interface where you flew when you went from server to server. It looked, if you remember Jurassic Park, there was sort of the like 3D-esque virtual fly. You know, when you went from one building to the other, it sort of flew to that building, and then that building enlarged and that kind of stuff. They actually had that for Gopher Space, which the sad part is once you got there, you basically clicked a thing and you had a list of documents to choose which one you wanted to download to your machine.
Somebody had been reading William Gibson. When William Gibson was describing that three virtual space, like there was a lot of visualization of maps of locations and like flying from place to place kind of thing going on.
All right, 713-526-5738. I see a phone call coming in. Well, now I'm on a quest to find open source robot pictures. But I found some great non open source robot pictures. There's a lot of robots on the internet.
I was watching you type. I thought you were looking for Pono pictures.
No.
But I guess the robots was part of that, Pone.
I feel like this story is going to haunt us for quite some time.
Pocahontas?
Oh. Can we only dump 8 seconds of air?
All right, Groovehouse.
Yes.
What?
Yes.
Who do we have up next?
All right, up next on the show, we're going to speak with Bob.
Bob, you're on the air with Technology Bytes.
Hey, thanks, guys. Enjoy your show. It's very topical. I'm going to have to say goodbye to a good friend at some point, my old XP machine, but that's not what I called about. It's not worth an iPhone. The laptop that I had it sent to died a long time ago. I've been updating it basically just over the internet, but I'm actually going to replace the phone too.
I'm sorry to say you're breaking up really bad.
Oh, well, that's my cell phone. Let me call y'all back. I'll wait till after dinner time and I'll give you a call.
All right, sounds good. Sorry about that. Yeah, sounded like he was calling on the phone.
It was like going through a cycle or something where it was dropping out every half second. Or it was half muting or something.
I've heard a rumor for all you people who are sticking with your XP that PC Hospital is going to open up PC Hospice next door that you can go with your XP in its final years.
Ease them gently out of life. Help them shuffle off this electronic coil.
All right, 713-526-5738. If you want to be on the air, I see a phone line ringing. Groovehouse, if you can manage that. Sorry to interrupt you from your computerly duties. All right, so we're going to We're going to probably get another call in here, and then we're going to take a short break and go to station business and come back with Barrett Time. So hopefully Groovehouse is actually screening a call. They're making him smile. They're, like, making him laugh. Make him smile. So what kind of phone is that, Barrett?
I got a – so I broke yet another phone. I broke the Nexus 5. And then I ordered a red Nexus 5, but it's not going to be showing up for a few weeks. So I got a Firefox phone, Firefox OS. So it's orange, which is really, it's been popular in the office. Like, I think someone had like one of the black dev Firefox OS phones. I was like, eh, okay. But you bring out an orange Firefox phone, everyone's like, ooh, ooh, let me see. So yeah, it's, the deal is it's Android based, I believe. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to create an operating system for phones that target low-end phones instead of like the high-end high-end smartphones like iPhones and stuff like that. So,
which is why I didn't buy it, because it seemed kind of limited functionality.
It's a little limited. I just wanted to kind of see what the deal was. The neat thing here is that all the applications are supposed to be written in HTML5, CSS, and JavaScript. So it's truly, you know, integrated with the web. It definitely, you know, this model right here is like, you can get it for 2 digits unlocked, pretty cheap. But, you know, along with that, it feels like a 2-digit cheap phone. But I do like the idea of this. So what it's going to do is it's going to give a lot of people around the world the opportunity to run an older version of Android without Google and without, you know, Android or any of the handset providers having to go and make these older versions faster. It's just going to run fast on anything, which is kind of neat.
All right. Groovehouse.
You think next they'll make Firefox books?
I don't know. I don't think that's going to go too well. But we'll see. We will see.
All right. Well, we're bumping up on the time on the break here. Is that right?
Yes.
3 minutes.
We can't really take 40 seconds.
How much?
I will start the ending music in about 45 seconds.
Ah, okay. So anyway, Foxfire phone.
Fire. Foxfire phone. That was a good movie.
Fire for your Foxfire phone.
Wait, no, that
phone,
was Fred. Firefox.
No, this is, oh, is Firefox a movie?
The
with
Clint
the
Eastwood,
helicopter?
The Clint Eastwood Russian
jet
movie? Yes, that was Firefox.
Okay, well, what's wasn't there a Foxfire movie too?
There was a Fox Force 5.
Foxfire
was
the... Was
that movie
like
ever
the,
made, though?
No, it really wasn't.
Catch up, Afflicted.
Like, old-fashioned, build-it-yourself, you know, weave your own clothing kind of movement back in the, like, 60s and 70s. They had books and stuff. Foxfire.
Did they weave their own mobile phones?
They'll only do that when everybody else has moved on to, like, Google Glass or something.
They're weaving their own web pages.
Code Weaver.
All right, well, we are going to... the sound of the music tells me it's time for us to consider backing away from the microphones.
Contemplate our show up.
We can check out any time we like, but we can never leave.
At least not for an hour from now.
Well, we could. So long, suckers! Answer your own damn computer questions.
This show, like XP, has reached its end of life. At 9:05 on whatever.
We're now vulnerable to...
End of life. End of line. All right.
End of line.
End of line.
End of file.
We're going to take a quick break here. We'll come back after a few messages, station business type messages, not commercials because we're commercial free. You're listening to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
And he's...
Groovehouse, go to 10.
I'm Jay Lee.
Did you know you can find KPFT on the social networking sites Twitter and Facebook? You certainly can, and we'd love you to add us as a friend and get us connected with friends of yours. Join our fan page and check out a special video message from General Manager Dwayne Bradley, as well as keep up with KPFT programmers and staff. Visit facebook.com/KPFT Houston to join us. To follow us, visit twitter.com/KPFT. With both, you can link up with other KPFT listeners, get the latest news about the station, and find lots of extras.
It's fun, so catch up with KPFT online. Again, on Twitter, visit twitter.com/KPFT. On Facebook, visit us at facebook.com/KPFT Houston. This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, 90.1 KPFT Houston. If you have friends in other cities who wish they had access to some of the great programming you hear on this station and the Pacifica Radio Network, we have a website for you.
PacificaNetwork.org gives community radio stations like this one complete information on how to become a Pacifica affiliate and information for listeners looking for community radio stations that air Pacifica programming.
With the launch of PacificaNetwork.org, Pacifica Radio is bringing together frequently requested items regarding Pacifica as a network.
Nearly 100 radio stations.
From Carbondale, Colorado to Benwood, West Virginia.
From Bend, Oregon to Hobbs Ferry, New York.
From Moscow, Idaho to Chicago, Illinois.
Have all made a statement by linking up and carrying Pacifica radio programming.
So tell your far-flung friends about PacificaNetwork.org to connect communities.
This is Pacifica Radio, KPFT, Houston.
You're listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston.
Hey, Barrett. What's happening?
I don't know.
Well, room around town.
We interrupt this skit to bring you...
Baritone! Yeah. That means it's time for... Yeah. Anyway. Take it away, Barrett.
Actually, we just did Barrett time. I got nothing. All right. remember back when the killer application of the internet was email? Actually, it's a bit of a myth, as email predates the internet. It was actually one of the tools crucial in creating it. In the early days of the internet, Usenet was king, and the wide area information server was the cutting edge of search. If you wanted to download a file, you needed a file transfer protocol client, something that's handled seamlessly by all modern web browsers today. To find these files, you had to turn to projects like Archie or the menu-driven Gopher. Though it didn't reach the unwashed college computer lab masses until 1993. Hey, Flicked It. It was on this day 25 years ago. That the notion of the World Wide Web was formalized by Sir Tim Berners-Lee in his document Information Management, a Proposal. In it, he outlines the issue facing the European Organization for Nuclear Research at the time and the potential solution based on this distributed hypertext system. So why the World Wide Web as a name? Why not the Information Mine or maybe the Mine of Information? Ooh. What about the Mesh? These were all contenders, actually, but Sir Tim thought the World Wide Web sounded best. Also, he was able to start global variable names with a capital W and not have them clash with other people's namespaces, also a perk. Had he gone with the information mine, we also might have been saying go to tim.geekradio.com rather than referring to the triple dubs. Okay, so the idea of the World Wide Web was published 25 years ago. We had our first web browser a few years later in the form of Mosaic, which was quickly replaced with Netscape's Navigator. So when was the first standard for the new hypertext transport protocol finally codified? Flicted probably has a shot at knowing this.
On a Wednesday?
On a Wednesday, yeah. I would like to know the day of the week now. That's got me curious. The specification for the HTTP 1.0 was published, and this is just the specification, was published in 1996 and actually didn't become an RFC until 1999 with HTTP 1.1. So quite a bit later. And this is pretty awesome. Sir Tim actually hung out on Reddit earlier, and when asked, what's one of the things you never thought the internet would be used for, but has actually become one of the main reasons people use the internet? Anyone want to guess
Cats.
What his answer was? So
Cats.
Close.
Ponos.
Kittens.
So close. Yes.
Bitcoins.
His answer? Kittens. Kittens, yeah. Nothing else I can say tonight is going to top that. Happy birthday, World Wide Web. That's it for your Mind of Information, and that's that for Barrett time.
Go to 10. All right. Well, this thing popped up on the internet, which is what it's really used for, as funny YouTube videos. And this video... You know, if you go looking for it, it's actually worth seeing. But the audio alone is good. But it is called the Epic Adventure to Fix the Internet, or and it's just great. And it features John Benjamin's voice doing the narration, which you will probably recognize him from Archer, as well as Bob's Burgers, two of my favorite adult cartoons.
Home Movies too.
Home Movies.
If you're not familiar, that's really good. That predates a lot of that, but he played Coach McGurk on that. It's three seasons. It is worthwhile.
All right. So we're going to play this for you, and it's about 4 or 5 minutes long, and it's totally worth it.
In which I fix my girlfriend's grandparents' Wi-Fi and am hailed as a conquering hero by Mike Locker. Low in the twilight days of the second year, of the second decade, of the third millennium, did a great darkness descend over the wireless internet connectivity of the people of 276 Ferndale Street. For many years, the gentlefolk of these lands basked in a wireless network overflowing with speed and ample internet. Many happy days did the people spend checking Hotmail and reading usatoday.com. But then one gray morning did Internet Explorer 6 no longer load the Google. The land was thrown into panic. Internet Explorer 6 was minimized, then maximized. The compact Rosario was unplugged, then plugged back in. The old mouse was brought out and plugged in beside the new mouse. Still, the Google did not load. Some in the kingdom thought this the work of the router, a relic whose origins were shrouded in mystery. And so, the people of 276 Ferndale Street did despair. But then, one morning, riding in upon a teal Ford Focus, came a great warrior, a suitor of the gentlefolk's granddaughter. Word had spread through the kingdom that this warrior worked with computers, and perhaps even knew the true nature of the router. The people did beseech the warrior to aid them, capable only of rewarding him with gratitude and a larger-than-normal serving of Jell-O salad. The warrior accepted the quest and strode bravely to where the router was rumored to be hidden, somewhere behind the recliner. Deep, deep behind the recliner did the warrior crawl over great mountains of National Geographic magazines and deep chasms of TV guides. At last he reached a gnarled thicket of cords, a terrifying knot of gray and white and black and blue, threatening to ensnare all who ventured further. The warrior arrived at the router. It was a dusty black box with an array of shimmering green lights. Gripping the cord tightly, he pulled with all his force. The heavens roared, the earth wailed, the green lights turned off. Silently, the warrior counted. 1, 2, 3. And just as swiftly, the warrior plugged the cord back into the socket. As the world around him seemed all but dead, the internet light began to blink. And so the Google did load. The good people of the kingdom were delighted and did heap laurels and Jell-O salad at the warrior's feet. A great celebration was held in his honor that lasted until 7:30 p.m. when the warrior was sent to the basement because the TiVo was doing something weird with the VCR.
That was great. I've listened to that thing several times, watched the video. If you go searching on the YouTubes or the Googles, an epic adventure to fix the internet with a voiceover by Sterling Archer. Wasn't that great?
Didn't you? Or
what?
Or the other guy.
Bob's Burgers. Yeah. Bob Belcher.
Or his real name.
Or his real name John is Benjamin. John Benjamin.
Yes.
Oh, that I'm guy. Sorry. You have to use his real name because Groovehouse.
Well, there's so many incarnations of him.
That's true.
Including Coach McGurk, which is where I first was introduced to him.
What's the name
Home
of that
movies.
I'll lend you the DVDs. Right? Yeah, I'm sure you can stream it, but they're really awesome.
They are great.
It's about maybe it's a kid in the summer between the third to fifth grade. He's like a little mini. He thinks he's like a Steven Spielberg. He likes to shoot.
Home movies. Yeah.
And he's got a gross little friend that has boogers and is, you know, all those kids, you know, the germy kid.
But
and then another girl, but it's awesome.
It's very adult. And it was on Cartoon Network.
Yeah. John Benjamin plays a slightly alcoholic soccer coach that takes Brendan under his wing.
Slightly in the style of Dr. Katz.
A little squiggly vision at first, and then it gets better. I think Paula Poundstone was on the first season playing one of the moms.
She's
and they've got some talent, and they bring in a lot of their friends.
Netflix last year.
I'll bring in the DVDs next Wednesday.
It's worth it. They're really funny and smart.
Maybe it's on Netflix in another country.
And check out Netflix Uganda.
What's that?
Finland.
There's a couple of Israeli guys that made a plug-in for your browser that allows you to pick what country you're in so that you can actually go to Netflix of any country so you can actually get access to stuff that's not available in America.
I think it's called The Bomb. Just Google for Israeli The Bomb. And someone will be at your house immediately to help you
The logo kind of looks like a ball of fire or something, and it's called... Man, I wish I'd just read a thing about it a month or two
ago. It's designed to replace, there are a lot of, VPN services that people buy, in other countries to fight oppression and also to be able to stream movies.
It's kind of a proxy system. I wish I could remember the name of it. Like Hot Pop or something?
Hot? Mm-hmm. No, that's not it.
Hot Pono.
Four seasons.
It's not Foxy Proxy, right?
No,
I like that name, though.
I don't think so.
No.
Cannot remember the name of it.
All right. 713-526-5738. If you are having trouble loading the Googles, we're here to help. A mighty warrior sits behind the control board, staring at his computer, waiting to answer the phone. Mighty warrior, wake up. Mighty warrior, save us.
Warrior needs food badly.
Can someone wipe some of the Cheeto dust off the mighty warrior, please?
Mighty warrior needs food badly.
He casts magic missile.
Cheeto
into the darkness.
Wow.
XP is about to die.
A saving throw of 101. I don't think there's a chance on this.
Coin detected in pocket. Groovehouse,
yes.
Who do we have up first, last, and forever?
On the second half of the show, that would be Ron.
Ron, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Hey, hello there.
Hello.
This is probably a worthless question to people as intelligent as y'all are, but is there a way to take an old floppy disk drive and hook it up to any kind of a new computer tower or system in order to access what is on it?
Yes.
I think computers still have
the five-inch floppy, not the 3-inch. Yeah.
Five and a quarter-inch floppy.
5 1/4 still uses IDE.
Yeah, 5 1/4.
Yeah, it connects via IDE cable. So if you have a computer that has an IDE port, you could do it that way.
I mean, some of the newer ones might only have SATA, but there's still a lot of motherboards that are made that have IDE.
It's in a computer that had the 99 problem.
But a 5 1/4-inch floppy
is
one.
Reboot it and everything, but you know, I kind of just quit using it, and I just want to try to hook it up to something else rather than install it in a new tower, but maybe that's the only way.
So what do you have on 5 1/4 floppy that you're trying to get after?
PGA Golf.
We may not want to know.
Leisure Suit Larry.
The 5 1/4 and the 3-inch one would be good too, but they're both one right under the other.
I mean, do you have those discs and you have data on it?
Yes. Most of them are just games or just fun stuff that I don't want to lose.
I would certainly consider trying to get that stuff archived off to a media that I mean, assuming that stuff hasn't corrupted.
Yeah, soon. We had some 5 1/4 inch floppies out at the Geek Gathering, and a lot of those were dead, actually. But those had also been sitting around for 25 years.
Right. I have some that are, but I can look at them, and I got a pretty good judge of whether they're decaying or not. But and magnetized or anything else, that I do not know.
You can also, you can also get a USB adapter to where you don't have to crack a case and worry about plugging in, you know, like one of the Ribbon IDE cables in the main board. That's another option.
So just have a USB and plug it from that computer to the other?
Yeah, you'll have to find an adapter. The adapters I'm looking at, I wouldn't get a $4 adapter. Those just scream cheap.
Okay, here's the other cheap deal. I had a problem with a child who decided to pour his bottle of whatever he was drinking through the hard drive port at the front, and, you know, so it didn't hurt the drives, but the hard drive's probably fried. Does that make sense?
No.
Okay, let's just say he fried the computer, but not the disk drives.
Right, so he dumped liquid into a computer, shorted out the circuit board. The hard drives are probably fine.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the circuit board's what screwed?
More than likely, yeah. Typically, when fluid gets spilled into a computer, it
was
doesn't...
It a...
You know, the little plastic thing that's usually on the front of a computer.
Was it a tower? Was it a tower or was it like
a
lathe?
Yeah, it was a tower.
Because if it was a tower and somebody poured liquid into the very front of it, it possibly might not have even actually hit the motherboard. It might have hit a hard drive or floppy drive controller or something like that. It might not actually hit the motherboard because usually the motherboard's on one side of it.
Okay, and yeah, so, it'd be right in the front. Now,
well,
okay,
I mean,
would it be worth trying to even get it repaired if it's like pre-99?
No.
That's what I think, but, you know.
Not unless it's a Cray.
I just want to try to get the floppy drives to either to play in something else or to re-record them on another medium.
Well, if you can pick up a relatively inexpensive computer that's a few years old that'll have IDE controllers on it, you could probably even find a computer if you went down to some place like Computer Works or something that might even, well, maybe a 5 1/4 drive.
Those are going to be
a little tough. It's going to be a little tough.
Fairly hard to find out now, I would think.
Yeah, 10 years too late.
You're going to have a harder time with any new computer running those games or, you know, they're just not going to work.
Yeah.
Although you could install a VM.
I guess. Yeah.
But I've got a 5 1/4 drive at home.
That's what I'm saying. I love these things and these games. I've got an XT that works perfect, but this is, you know, a Pentium Tower, and now it's won't work. But I've got an XT from the early 80s, and it plays everything perfect.
You can play Microsoft Flight Simulator.
Yeah.
Only 16 discs.
Yeah, it's the discs. But whatever, it plays. I like Zaxxon's my favorite, I think.
All right.
Oh, it's got a color monitor? It's got a color monitor?
Oh, yes.
Wow.
Whatever, 16 RBG, whatever it said. Yeah. I don't remember.
I am looking on eBay and trying to see if there are any 5 1/4.
That's 16 color is the first VGA version, right?
Yeah, that's the one I got. I think it was 82. I'm not sure. I think so.
No. Anything on there? There should be. I think there'd be a handful of floppy drives out there.
I'm seeing a 5 1/4 USB 8-in-1 SD reader, but that's not a 5 1/4 floppy USB. I was trying to see if there's anything that would let you read a 5 1/4 floppy drive via USB.
See, I've got a 3 1/4.
I've seen 3 1/4, 3.5.
Goes straight to USB.
I've seen those.
But not 5 1/4.
No, I haven't seen the 5 1/4. What you're going to have to find is a USB to like
to IDE.
Parallel ATA or serial ATA or IDE, and that'll get you in there. The ones I was seeing had all three on there, so you would actually plug in the USB, and then you would plug in that Ribbon IDE cable into the device, and then that would let you see it. Hopefully it's got enough USB power to spin the drive.
That'd be probably not.
It might need an external thing, but
extra power.
Yeah, I don't see if any of those games are just out there on the internet. Maybe on a
they might be public domain,
right? Because the other question would be, can you get a newer computer with its high speeds to emulate the slower older computer speeds?
There are a number of emulators out for like a lot of the old arcade games and stuff like that.
You just have to turn off the turbo button.
Yeah. Or be really, really, really fast at the keyboard.
Like the game stopped before you started.
Yeah, I remember that used to happen to me with Centipede.
Anyway, well, I thank you, and I really didn't want to bore you all with my little problem. But
all right, well, thanks for your call.
Bye-bye.
Have a good night. Bye-bye. All right.
This was interesting. Somebody was telling me, I didn't actually see this, but somebody was talking about they took some young kids and they set a...
rotary phone?
An old rotary phone in front of them and asked them if they knew what it was at all and then how you used it, and then they asked them how would you send and receive text messages on it. And one of them...
One of the kids whipped out a coupler?
Well, no, one of them was like, well, okay, yeah, so you were like, if you wanted to send a B, you would do this twice to get B, and they're like, oh, but... But then how would the other person get it? Does it read it back to you over the phone? And then they asked them, and then they played a busy signal for them and asked them if they knew what it was. And none of them knew what a busy signal was.
Wow.
They were like, oh, it's because if somebody's on the phone, then you can't use it because there's a busy signal. And they didn't. That concept wasn't there for them either. But, yeah, if you think about it, I mean, really, like most of them have ever seen is people with cell phones. Mm-hmm. Or maybe more modern landlines, but a lot of it's just cell phones. So it didn't look like... Because I was thinking, well, it still looks like a receiver, but the only place they're going to see those is probably on TV, like in older movies or something. They're going to see, you know, people with receivers, and that even those aren't going to have rotary on them most of the time. So
I can hardly stand it when I'm watching a movie now where they have to pull over to make a phone call.
Well, somebody just said would take it with me. And they're like, yeah, but it has to have a cord connecting it. It has to have a cord connected somewhere. It has to stay, because that was freaking them out too. Like the only way, they were like, so you have to be at home to get a call. And if you want to call somebody, they have to be at home too. Like when are you going to ever be able to talk to someone? And then they started talking about long distance charges. And they were like, wow, like nobody would call anybody. Like, if my grandparents called to wish me happy birthday, they'd say, happy birthday, and hang up, because it would be too expensive.
Exactly.
I was like, yeah, that's pretty much what's happened.
I can't talk long, because this is costing a lot of money.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I wanted to wish you a happy birthday from Dallas or
we crossed over
Alaska.
2 seconds. All right, you've got 55 more seconds now.
Yeah.
In-state long-distance calling, that was something.
Yeah, the other thing they probably didn't mention, you know, yeah, they have long distance charges, but think about it. Back on the rotary dial and even the touchtone phones, you didn't own the phone.
You
rented
it
from the phone company monthly unless you made a special deal and paid for it.
Yep.
Well, they rent home routers, though. So
yeah, I was going to say, we're
routers.
Being snide about that. How many people pay monthly for their home internet?
Yeah, the
routers.
Difference was, though, it was if you go back far enough, it was very difficult to find a phone that you could wire in. You know, it was hardwired in for sale to go. It was before, you know, before they had the modular
plugs, all the
cocks on the wall,
before all the Conair phones came out.
I remember I had a phone, a rotary phone, or it might have been a touchtone phone, but I had a regular old phone, square boxy phone with the spiral cord that had for the handset.
Just old Southwestern Bell design.
Yeah, Southwestern Bell design phone. And
I forgot that model number, but it's
a
really famous one.
And I had one that was like not being used for anything. It was like it was mine. And I remember I put it in my 1971 Buick 225 on the console there and cradled the earpiece on my shoulders. I'm driving down the road. And
what's
people,
up, baby?
What's happening?
I'll be by to pick you up later.
My mobile phone.
I've actually got one of those. I have a black Southwestern Bell rotary phone like that.
You can still wire those into the house.
Man, those ring loud.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they're mechanical, right? I mean, real actual
bells,
bell, real metal. Yeah,
metal bells. They're loud.
All right, well, we got some calls in the queue. We've got open phone lines if you want to reminisce, or if you want to talk about XP, or if you want to, you know, just chat about computers, technology, having a problem, want a solution, or whatever. Call 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. Groovehouse,
mm-hmm.
You there?
Uh-huh. Whoa.
Yeah,
he sounds like Flicted. He's all depressed now.
Mm-hmm. Lethargic.
Mm. Huh? Flicted's all happy.
Coffee's not doing its job.
What's up, Lothario?
Hey. Hello, lady.
Lethargico.
Lethargio.
Do you have a call for us?
Yes, I do.
Well, who is it?
Up next, we are going to speak with Bob.
Bob, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Hey, thanks, guys. I was the one who called in with the orphan phone question. The terrible phone, which was actually the phone I'm going to replace. So
your voice is unrecognizable from your previous call.
Right. Well, I hope this is better. This is
much better.
Actually a good old landline copper wire telephone.
Yeah, it sounds great.
Doesn't sound like a rotary though.
No, I do have one of those though. But anyway, yeah, I've really enjoyed the show. I've smiling listening to some of that old stuff. This is obviously old people night.
Is it a banana phone?
No.
So what can we do?
I do have a 4-year-old iPhone. It's an orphan, meaning that the computer that it was once the mothership is long gone. And I don't have anything. The only stuff I have on the phone that I care about are my contacts, pictures, videos, stuff like that. I did get an iCloud account a while back.
I was going to say, what iPhone version is it?
Oh, thank you. It's an old iPhone 4. Not 4S, but 4.
Okay. Have you upgraded to iOS 5 or 6 or 7?
It's got one of the latter versions of 6. I have not upgraded to 7 yet.
Okay. So have you got enough room in the cloud to store your files? Okay, so really all you should – what I would do, I would just make sure you back it up to iTunes. No? What?
I can't do that. First of all, I'm not worried about the music on the phone.
Okay.
I've got that elsewhere. But I can't back up – I don't believe I can back up the anything. Okay, I've got 15 gig of iCloud storage. And it says I'm only using less than a gig, which is really weird because I've, the phone has a lot more stuff on it than that. And I don't believe it backs up the music to iCloud.
Okay, so what?
See, the thing is he originally had it synchronized to a computer that's now gone.
Oh, I see.
And so if he hooks it up to a new computer, I think it'll say...
This
was attached
status.
To another computer, so if you want to sync it with this one, we're going to wipe it and start you over again.
Yeah, and that's okay with me as long as I keep my contacts and everything but the music. I don't.
Do you have your contacts tied to a Gmail account?
Yes, it is.
Do you? If you log onto a computer connected to the Googles and you go to Gmail, do you see your contacts there?
I'll check. I haven't tried that, but I bet.
Because if your contacts are there, then really all you have to do is get the new phone, add the Gmail account to it, and it should pull down your
contacts. I know what you're saying. I do know what you're saying. The contacts in Gmail are kind of old. I quit updating those when I went to when I got the phone. So I know what you're talking about. You can do that.
I did something at some point. I don't even remember what, some magic incantation, and now, like, all my contacts are just synchronized with each other across Gmail and the iPhone and my Mac and iCloud, and I don't even remember what I did. I just, at some
point,
I did it.
That's really what I need to do is something like that. I'm horribly disorganized at this point. It would be nice now if everything just worked, but I haven't quite figured out the magic. But just... for lack of, perfection, I really just need to be sure that the contacts get backed up. The iCloud backup says they're backed up.
Well, you know,
I think you might be able to back up your photos even if you don't synchronize with that computer.
Right.
Because you can just grab them. You can actually, on a Windows computer, you can connect it, and you can actually browse the contents of the phone and pull the photos off.
If is that you, right? Because that would solve my problem.
Now, okay, so you're getting a new phone, right? A new
I iPhone. Am getting a new phone.
So what you should conceivably be able to do is turn off the phone that you have now, get the new phone, turn it on, log into your iTunes account, or log into your
iCloud
account. See if the phone
see
what populates.
Pulls over.
What populates?
Yeah,
that sounds. That's what other people have told me to do, and I think that's what I'm going to try.
There are.
I wonder
there,
if there's. A, is there? I've never looked. Are there third party backup tools for iPhone that you can use besides iTunes?
I tried one of those, and it wound up putting a virus on my laptop.
There are tools you can use to actually take the contents of the phone and back it up.
I know, like I used to have. There was a piece of software called iPod Rip.
Yeah,
you could use to rip
SharePod
all the music off of iPods.
I do not recommend that at all.
Well, I had a really the most I've ever had to use something like that is I had a friend who lost his hard drive full of music and had to recover his entire music library, which was pretty extensive, off of an iPod. And we used one of those programs.
That's really hard, actually.
We used one of those programs, though, and it got it all. It pulled it all down, and we just pulled all the MP3s off the phone, lock, stock, and barrel.
Well, fortunately, the music that's on the phone is a subset of what I've got on, you know, backed up elsewhere, and I don't have any problem, you know, just putting that on the new phone. I just don't want to lose my contacts. I don't want to lose my pictures and videos. Got a bunch of baby videos on there. Those things they're even more entertaining than cat videos.
If you say so.
Well, if it's a grandbaby, that means you just get to enjoy the fun part.
Well, I suppose, you know, that all comes with having kids, so more power to you.
Yeah.
All right, well, thanks for your call. Good luck with the phone.
Thanks, guys. Great show.
Thank you very much. Have a good night.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
What are you two yammering about?
We had a caller call in and say that you could look up. This is why I don't want to always tell you what we were talking about, because I don't exactly remember. But the guy said something along the lines is, if you have a iPhone that no longer syncs, there's a way to work around it where it'll allow you to sync up to like 5 devices or something. You can look it up on Apple Topics or Apple Talk or something.
I will say this. There's another option too. I mean, you could just schedule an appointment with a genius at the Apple Store, and they will tell you exactly.
But you can sync 5 devices through
iTunes,
that's what he mentioned. Yeah, he mentioned
iTunes. But you can't
iTunes.
Sync a phone to more than one.
But I
iTunes.
Think the phone can only be plugged in. It has one system that it has to sync to, I think.
Yeah.
Call a genius. There you go.
But seriously, though, if you're worried about losing anything, go to the Apple Store and they'll tell you what you can do. But I think, for the most part, if you just fire up the new phone, it will, and you plug in your Gmail account, it's going to pull that down. You can get the files. You can get the image files and the videos of your grandchild off there, and no problem. All right, Groove House?
Yes.
Who's up next?
Up next, we are going to speak with John.
John, you're on the air with Technology Bytes.
Yes, gentlemen, good evening. You had a caller about 45 minutes ago that I think his name was Gary. He has an old XP machine, and he was afraid of opening up emails. Well, there's a method where, and I'm using the same XP, but I've got Outlook Express, which, believe it or not, still works. If he right-clicks on the email, go down to Properties, a window will pop up. You'll see Message Source. Click on that, and it then expand it, and it will. You can see exactly what the email is, who sent it, what it's all about, without actually opening up the email in case there's a virus in there. Have you all ever heard of that method?
If you look at the message source without opening the message?
Correct.
I don't remember it. Yeah, it's been so long since I've used
Outlook Express.
The hard thing with Outlook Express and the hard thing with the kinds of exploits that can come across with clicking on an email is that they're usually embedded with JavaScript, or they're usually embedded with, you know, with some kind of scripting that will, you know, cause harm. So to view the message source, a lot of times you've got to click on the message, which will bring it up in a pane.
And see, then as long as you don't have the preview pane, and you single click on the message and don't double click because that will open it.
Yeah.
And then right click on it. Then you probably could view message source, and it wouldn't actually load the HTML or any of the JavaScript or anything.
First of all, you've got to suspect that the message is malicious before you want to go through that kind of rigmarole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I will tell you this. I've been dealing with email a long time, and I can usually tell by the subject and the sender whether or not it's anything I want to mess with.
I'm a risk taker. I like to open messages sometimes.
I want to see what this lonely housewife has to say.
Pardon me?
I'm sorry.
They're just joking.
That's spam mails. Sorry.
It can't be. I cannot have enough length or hair in my life. I open it all.
I'm so confused.
It's okay.
We're talking about the kind of spam, you know, that comes in and Barrett's being a little facetious about, like, he knows it's bad and he opens it anyway.
Oh, okay. There,
you know, by looking at who it's from and by looking what Jay's saying, by looking at the subject line, you can tell if it's, you know, from a family member you know, or if it's, you know, something you're expecting, or if it's something that obviously someone's just phishing and hoping you'll click on it.
Or it's a faked message from a family member you know that's actually got a virus in it.
The better way to do that, it's probably a lot less time intensive just to keep all your AV patched, you know, to use some common sense when opening up messages, but you know, going through and viewing the headers and the message source on everything is just painfully
slow. Or just call somebody every time you get a message. Call them and ask them if they sent you a message.
I saw that you emailed me. What did you say?
Well, you say it's kind of hard to do. It takes me roughly 5 seconds to do all that. Maybe
and then
I'm
you
got to
know what you're looking at when you're looking at all the headers in the content, because what will happen is, you know, and that's more power to you if that's the way you want to do it. But, you know, you right-click on the message, you select view source, you look at the source, you're going to see the who's it from and who's it to. And if there's an attachment in it, you're going to see all of that MIME.
You're just
going to
see encoded or MIME encoded. But as long as it's as long as the message still has the text, you know, a text-only version in there, you can actually see part of the body of the message. If it's HTML only, then you're going to kind of have problems getting through some of that.
You can achieve the same thing if you want to go into Outlook Express and disable JavaScript, disable ActiveX, disable any kind of scripting, disable loading of remote content, disable, you know, all that kind of stuff. You will eventually reduce that to text. That's what you want to do. The emails got dangerous when the email client started deciding to do very real things based on what was in those emails.
You install Pine for PC.
Yeah, yeah. No.
I used to use that.
Fetchmail and Emacs is what you want to do. And again, we're kidding.
Okay. Well, I thought I'd just call in and throw that out for discussion. Thank you very much and good evening.
All right.
Thanks.
Good night. Thank you. You guys.
I did run Pine for PC for years.
I still use. I've got a Pine account. If I need to like send an emergency email as a test, you know, from a server, I'll hop into Pine. It's a lot easier than the other alternatives.
I just send it straight from SendMail, like just mail from the command line, usually without a body or attachments or anything. If I have to send attachments or something, then yeah, I'll have to hop into something else. But yeah, I'll send messages straight from the command line to send test messages.
I tell net into port.
Usually, what I do is I tell net into port 25. Hello, whatever. Mail from whatever. Recipient to whatever. Data, subject, whatever.
We've had to go like a SASL and TLS and everything on those, which makes it a lot harder.
No, you just use OpenSSL. You OpenSSL, /connect/host:port. And you might need to put in there's another dash option, a CRLF or something. You do that, and it'll make a TLS connection, SMTP TLS connection.
Dude, that's awesome.
Yeah.
So carriage turn line feed option. Yeah. That's what it sounds like. Okay, cool.
We'll have to use that next time we have a caller with an email problem. Well, we're going to teach you how to do it at the command line.
All right, you have Open Secure Shell installed. Okay. What version?
Nerds.
We got a call.
713-526-5738. If you'd like to be on the air with us tonight, we are accepting phone calls at that phone number. Groovehouse likes to have a lengthy conversation with you about whatever it is you got to talk
about.
The
things I save you from. You have no idea the calls that could get through.
I'm so grateful for you, Groovehouse.
Line 3 wants to know what Jay Lee's wearing.
And then I got to go on and on and on and on. They want to know all the details.
Is it cotton? Is it a polycotton blend?
Right. Is it tucked in? Does he have a belt?
There are no victims here, only volunteers. You signed up for this. All right, Groovehouse.
Yes.
Who do we have?
Up next, we're going to speak with Gary.
Gary, you're on the air.
Hello again, and I heard you guys talking about, I heard that fella call.
Where did you save me from?
listen, this is something you're going to appreciate. You were talking about how kids today can't believe anybody has a landline. They don't know what dial means. And there's a humorist named Dave Barry who wrote about Generation Text. All right, this is our new generation. He has a 14-year-old daughter, and they're totally computer-oriented. And I just wanted to read this to you. It's called The Post Office. Many younger people have never sent a letter. When my son Rob was in college, he had to send a letter for some reason. What I do remember is that he called to ask some technical questions, such as, and I'm not making this up, one, where could he get a stamp? Were there different kinds of stamps? Well, then, which one should he buy? How much would it cost? What should he physically do with the letter when it was finally ready to go? Rob was quite annoyed that the letter mailing procedure was so complicated. Now, you talk about us old farts going to Windows 8 and finding that complicated, and these kids can't even mail a stinking letter.
But they can teach you how to use your new operating system.
Thanks. Goodbye.
Bye. All
and
right.
You have to lick the stamp. You don't have to lick your
phone.
Oh,
those are old stamps.
It's the pace of modern life. Yeah, this is, I found this. Someone wrote, let me read this. The art of letter writing is fast dying out. Well, the letter costs 9 pence, it seemed, but fair to try and make it worth 9 pence. Now, however, we think we're too busy for such old-fashioned correspondence. We fire off a multitude of rapid and short notes instead of sitting down to have a good talk over a real sheet of paper. The Sunday Magazine, 1871. it's been going downhill for a while now, folks.
And the response was, lol, letter, LTR, writing, RITING,
There's a great webcomic. It's called XKCD. It's a webcomic of romance, sarcasm, math, and language. And they have a comic called The Pace of Modern Life. And the guy has found, like, all these clips from letters to the editor and all these famous newspapers, starting in 1871, 1886, 1890. People saying, it's pretty neat, but every single letter is saying, the letter's dead. This new technology is killing our modern ability to communicate in kids these days. So it's pretty neat. For 200 years worth.
Let's say, I wish people still wrote me letters every once in a while, because I think I'd just start sending back postcards that said TLDR.
I've got this, and I can't remember what exactly it says on it, because it's very clever. It was a bit of a rhyme message, but it is actually a telegram that my great-grandfather received on the occasion of the birth of his child. My great-grandfather's sister, when she was born. So it is actually a Western Union telegram, and it's, you know, so they had to receive it electronically and then transcribe it by hand.
Those people do that fast.
Yeah.
Amazing. I mean, how fast those are going.
But, you know, I mean, if you're the telegraph operator, I wonder if you know, today, if it was a telegraph operator, it'd come across, they'd go, send me money. They would write down whatever. Hey, how's it going? Oh, they want you to call them back. You know, they wouldn't even try.
It's a boy. I didn't even know they were pregnant.
Who's it from? Oh, you know, it's probably somebody that you know that's pregnant.
Your uncle.
You'd have surly telegraph operators.
But imagine the headlines. Is the telegraph operator reading your private
Whoa.
That's true. Your stuff is just kind of out there. It's the same thing with the switchboard operators at the telcos. Are your phone calls
they're the
really
most informed person in the entire city, I would assume, as far as gossip and everything goes.
Yeah. My wife told me, I mean, when she was a kid, at their house, they had she grew up on a farm, and they had a party line.
Yeah. Shared loop line that multiple houses would share, and only one person, one party could use it at the time. So you
right,
pick
but
it
other
up
people
and see
could
if it was
listen.
In use.
Yeah, you have to pick it up and see if anybody was on it, and if they were, the polite thing to do is to hang up.
The impolite thing, though, would be to...
I'm living on a farm and starve for entertainment. But, you know, when somebody came by the radio station a number of years ago and they had brought a police scanner that was modified to pick up cell calls back before cell calls.
Oh, yeah, before it was all encrypted, yeah.
Before it was all encrypted, so you could actually, it would scan and you would get a cellular conversation going. And I will tell you the one greatest bit of security for cell phones is the fact that most people's conversations are so boring. They're not worth listening to. It was all just people arguing with each other or
what are you doing? I don't know. What are you doing?
But the other one was drug deals. There are a lot of drug deals going on cell phones. I need two. I'm looking to pick up a QP for a quarter pound or some. I need to get a couple of OZs. And once you got the lingo down, it was encrypted because it was whatever jargon. All right, Groove House.
Yes.
What was that about?
There it is. You were being corrected.
Oh, hold on.
A telegraph wasn't sent electronically, but electrically. Due to disruption of the electric signal. Yes.
Yes.
That's
signaling.
True.
Yes.
Yes.
We are cutting edge, and we need to remain.
Yes, every
way.
Time you hear one of those scare stories about solar storms, they talk about how the telegraph lines lit up. From the last big one in the 1800s, where suddenly the telegraphs started going by themselves and it freaked everybody out.
Carrier pigeon is the true trusted technology.
I guess telegraph was 3-bit.
Because
you had off,
3-bit.
Short, and long.
Tertiary, yeah.
No, that's 2-bit.
Tertiary? 3-bit. 3? I think it's 3. Binaries, too. Trinary.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm getting my
cardinal numbers. It was
actually
the first quantum because you didn't really know if they were going to send any more signal.
They had to say stop all the time. Just like when you talk on a CB, you have to say on a walkie-talkie, you have to say over.
Please stop. I wish. I guess did the old telegraph stuff come out?
Say all those old telegraph jokes just don't work anymore.
Yeah. Did the stuff come on like ticker tape stuff, or would you come out on like a postcard? So I wonder if anyone ever did like ASCII telegraphs.
Art.
Yeah, the telegraph.
No, I mean it was just a machine that made a ticking sound, and the person listened. And
yeah, when they wrote it down, but I know there was at some point
that,
they actually would
that,
type
it
down.
It.
Yeah, it automated it. Or like the typewritten ones, you know, like the Western Union, where they would come on a card. It always looked like a square card to me, to where the idea of ASCII art could actually be
so
possible.
The ones I remember seeing were like mimeograph paper that were this little bit bigger than an index card. That's what I remember. Western Union telegrams.
The paper?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was about the size of a postcard. Maybe just a tiny bit bigger and very flimsy paper. Yeah. That's why I'm surprised that I still have. I mean, I've got the one that's in my great grandfather's journal, and I pulled it out, and it's all intact. Western Union logo.
Did you have to go pick up them, or did they mail them to you?
They would. I think they had delivery if you wanted to pay a lot for it, but you would also go to the office, wouldn't you? The Western Union office.
When I was using,
but how
the
would
telegraph,
you know you were getting one?
I think
if. My whole knowledge of this comes from Wild West, you know, Westerns. So I think if a bad guy escapes and you want to know what train he's on, you know to go to the telegraph office, I think.
Because every telegraph sent was in reply to a telegraph sent. So you knew that if
so it was
you
like the largest chain letter ever.
If you knew that if you had sent a telegraph, that chances are you were waiting on a reply. So every day you would go by the telegraph office to see if anybody had replied. And then while you're waiting for your reply.
Yeah, but how did when you sent it that the first time, how did the other person know to come get it?
Because you were
Who started that chain?
Because you were replying to him.
But who
there
started
was
that
no
chain?
First telegraph.
It's telegraphs all the way down.
Yeah. Man.
I would imagine, you know,
infinite monkeys writing telegrams.
I don't know how all that worked. I think that perhaps there was. I would imagine that the average person didn't receive a telegraph. So if you were someone who was the kind of person who would receive a telegraph, you probably have something in place to either be notified or you go check.
You had couriers to just go and check for you.
Didn't they send what?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, how long did telegraphs last, and how big were the population centers that received them? I don't know. They probably just
because I think if it was a small enough town, then everybody's going to know that you got one and what it says.
But I don't know that
before you do.
I don't know. Well, I say what the four fastest ways to transmit information: telephone, telegraph, television, and telewoman.
All by now obsolete and or misogynist.
at the beginning of the telegraph, the they had some problems.
The first light up.
At the beginning of the telegraph, they had problems with the business model because they figured out they needed to pay in advance because otherwise the person had already heard what was on the telegram and then wouldn't pay for it.
Brazil has a very large system of collect calls that are like that, where they've got keywords, and they'll be like, hey, you've got a collect call from not going to make it to the restaurant, meet you 15 minutes later, will you accept? No, thanks.
It's hard to believe that telegraph cables actually went transatlantic across the ocean.
Yeah, that's crazy. Just having to be one of those old ships pulling it across. And then they usually follow the railroads too, I believe. Like pretty much every time they put up a railroad, they would string along a telegraph. So that's usually when a town got connectivity with railroads, they also got connectivity to the rest of the telegraph network. I'd be curious though to see if there are actual telegraph chain letters. Like, you must pass this along or else, you know, your wagon wheel's going to fall off.
Well, the cost, I don't know what the cost was, but it had to have been fairly expensive. I think you paid by the word.
By the letter, probably. Maybe by the letter.
I think it was by the word.
Was it?
I think. Although I don't know what happened if you strung all of them into one word.
I'm egregiously.
If we paid by the letter, we'd have had lolspeak a lot earlier.
Yeah.
Yes.
Lol what?
TLDR.
Yeah.
TLDS. Didn't spell.
I forgot about the fact that, some people used to use collect calls to, tell people things.
Yeah.
I forgot about that.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure if they charge by the word, it's like, yes, sir, we do charge by the word. So the telegram you want to say is, okay, and that's, let me get this right, you're Mr. I'm coming on the 330 train.
I remember having to make collect calls because they didn't have quarters for the payphone. And so a lot of times, or if you just didn't want to spend the money, you would say, you'd shout it in there real quick. They would say, we have a collect call from Jay Lee. And I says, don't accept the charges. I'm on my way.
It's a boy.
It's a trap.
All right. 713-526-573. Actually, we're probably out of time. Yeah. We got two calls in the queue. Let's see if we can dial those in.
All right. Next up, we're going to speak with Ken.
Ken, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Hey, you guys. I was wanting to tell you guys a little bit about teletype. You know, the transition from telegraph to teletype involved a man named Baudot, and he invented what's called frequency-shifted keying, FSK, and everything we do today is all frequency-shifted keying, and that technology was invented in the 1870s. It's really an incredible layer of technology. But that shift from what was constant wave or continuous carrier, just carrier, on-off carrier, it went through, the carrier was always on, but on top of that was encoded another code that it would shift the frequency back and forth so the transmitter or the emitter didn't have to turn all the way down off power then back on power. It just shifted its frequency, and this allowed it was a huge breakthrough in technology, and everything we do today is all frequency shifting.
So it's in 1910, so it's like, they invented the two-tone method of transmitting.
So it's like frequency modulation, kind of.
Yeah.
Like you basically got a carrier wave.
You can put a frequency shifted keying. You can put frequency shifted keying on FM, or you can put it on AM. You can put it on any signal. But what they were doing initially was on wires, and they were just using tones, like you were talking about.
Yeah. Cool.
And I think they used a four-tone schematic, you know, and various tones and various schemes have been proprietary over the various times until they became standardized, and we have these standardized systems now. I mean, when the internet really lit up, you know, it was Bell 202, and everybody was dialing 1200 baud, and that was it. Mm-hmm. And it was all frequency shifted king. But it's interesting that the technology that we were using in, say, 1994, 1995, was invented 120 years prior.
Something to think about.
It is.
All right. Well, anyway, appreciate you calling with that information. Thank you very much.
All right. Good night.
All right.
Yeah, go. Google FSK if you're curious about that. Wikipedia actually has a decent write-up on it.
Groovehouse, I see we have a call in the queue.
Yes, we do.
Who is it?
We're going to speak with Tony.
Tony, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Yeah, okay. One of the things you mentioned about the operator that could hear all the phone calls.
Yeah.
That's Lily Tomlin.
And then one ringy dingy.
At Hamburger Place, the little guy, the short guy walking around with the tray and he had a piece of paper on it was saying, Western Union Graham for Philip Morris. And so that's how they delivered a lot of stuff. On the Western Union part of it. In 1989, I was in Dallas at the Interactive Laser Disc meeting when some group came and said they were going to totally wire a city in Florida, every house in the whole city for free to see how the internet would interact between them. And there were, I forget how many, it was like maybe 2,000 or 3,000 people there, but it was they all worked at this one company. And so when they did that, that was 89. Then about 2 years later, I was in Houston at a different conference where the guys came in from Austin and said they were doing the ISDN. Mm-hmm. And it was supposed to be a big boom, but nobody used it consumer-wise. But if you wanted to buy 100 stainless steel screws, you'd be able to see it online and order it and never have to talk to anybody. And so those are a couple of steps that it's worked its way through. And now we're where we're at, and I quit paying attention a long time ago, and I'm like blowing in the wind, lost.
Yeah.
But in the very beginning, it was really exciting and to see that there were great opportunities. There still are, though. You just got to figure out what they are and then go after them.
Yeah, it was an amazing time back then. It's an amazing time now.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I appreciate your call tonight.
All right. Bye.
All right. Well, we are pretty much running out of time here in this episode of Technology Bites.
Of 18th and 19th, 20th century Technology Bites.
So I will see your 25-year-old internet or World Wide Web and up you a party line. Let's go back 50 years.
So what? give me a basic of the frequency shifted.
So so what he's talking about, it's kind of hard to see. So you look at what we were talking about was you had a binary system. So the signal's either on or off.
Right.
So the deal is turning something on and off in a very hard way can be really, really hard on the power, you know, on the equipment because of power cycling.
Right.
So what they do is they do two different sine waves and then they just mush these sine waves. So when the sine waves line up, it's like you've got an on. When they kind of come out of sync, you've got an off.
Okay.
So you're never turning stuff on and off. You're just modulating. You can either modulate the frequency or you can modulate the amplitude.
Right.
And that's, I don't know that much about it, but that's how
they were saying they had it where they were getting like four frequency levels out of it. So they could use that. Interesting.
Yeah, you could shift it different ways. So it's just all about, you know, like baseband signaling and what's on, what's off. Not much has really changed. That's the thing. It's like we're still kind of operating on all this tech that was discovered.
That's why I was asking about frequency modulation because you have the carrier wave and then you add the signal on top of that. And then when it gets to the, like in your car, gets to your car unit, that strips the carrier wave off and it leaves behind the signal that was riding on the carrier wave, and that's the music or talking or whatever it is.
It's mind-boggling. Consider how old radio technology is. You're still using this old-fashioned way of talking to the people of Houston.
Thank you, Tesla. Not Marconi.
All right, well, it looks like it is it's time to wrap up. Yeah.
I got behind. I'm a minute behind now.
Oh, no.
We only have 30 seconds.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you've been listening to Technology Bites.
I frequency modulated it by a minute. Time shifting.
You've been listening to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
And he's
Roofhouse.
We'll see you next Wednesday night. Have a good week.
Happy birthday, KPFT. Take two. We're throwing a big top birthday bash to celebrate KPFT's 44th birthday. Who? You. Where? McGonagall's Mucky Duck, 2425 Norfolk, just off Kirby and 59. When? This Sunday, March 16th, starting at high noon. Who's going to play? Shiny Ribs, Del Castillo, Parker Millsap, Lisa Morales, Anika Chambers, Circe, and Robert Kuhn. Why? Well, it's a birthday party. Come on. Tickets are $20. It all goes to support KPFT, your local community Pacifica radio station. Be there. Look forward to it. Thank you. KPFT Houston.
We live in a world that privileges greed, encourages competition, and runs on fear. We could be living in a world that privileges service, encourages cooperation, and runs on love. Stirrings of that new world are present now, within each of us, and within the social movements we are part of. Join us on Thresholds, 3 to 4 p.m., on Thursdays, for conversations with people who are working to make the seeds of that world bloom in the present, to bring into being a world where children can grow up without ever doubting their worth, where women would have the same access to society's resources as men do, where work would be an expression of our love of the world and desire to be of service. You'll hear and be able to speak with people who are attempting to meet the greatest challenges of the present, an increasingly dysfunctional economic system, and an ecological crisis that requires global cooperation to resolve.